Well, good afternoon, colleagues, and a very warm welcome to guests from outside the school here. My name is George Gaskell. I'm a pro-director. An event such as this reminds us that the school really is a community. And here today we gather to mourn the passing of Peter Louisos and to celebrate his life. As you will hear from some of his many friends and colleagues, he was a pillar of the anthropology department, and to use Ralph Dahrendorf's term, he was a committed citizen of the London School of Economics. For almost four decades, I knew him. He was a great friend. We shared stories, we shared our research interests, and enjoyed each other's company, and I will miss him a great deal. May I introduce Deborah James, professor and head of the Department of Anthropology, who is going to coordinate this afternoon's meeting.
Welcome to all of you. Could you please turn off your mobile phone? Or at least put it on silent. Unless you're going to Twitter, which I hope you don't. So I'm really just the master of ceremonies here. I did know Peter well, and I'm not going to say a speech about him, but I'm going to introduce the different speakers who come from a variety of Peter's professional and personal life. So first of all, we're going to introduce Alan McFarlane from Cambridge, who will tell you a bit about Peter's student days and also show a bit of his film. Alan. Yes.
Thank you, Deborah. I first met Peter in 1966 when we both came to the LSE to do a two-year conversion course in social anthropology. There were giants in those days. Among our teachers were the last of the great generation of structural functionalists: Raymond Firth, Lucy Mayer, Isaac Shapira, as well as slightly younger Turks already making a mark: Maurice Friedman, Robin Fox, James Woodburn, Anthony Forge, Burton Benedict, Suti Ortiz, and others. We also interacted with broad thinkers in neighboring departments, such as Percy Cohn, Ernest Gellner, Ronald Dorr, and David Glass. And among our contemporaries at that time were several who would become distinguished anthropologists: Andrew and David Turton, David Seddon, Louise Muratu, among others. Yet amidst this glittering group, Peter stood out in various ways, and he became one of my two best friends and influential mentors. He was older than me, some 5 years, and much more experienced. He had traveled to America on an Ox Fellowship, worked in film in the BBC, and had married into the distinguished Nobel Prize family of the Medawars. He was obviously very bright, a double first in English at Cambridge in the Leavis, Donald Davy, Raymond Williams era. And there was something exotic and cosmopolitan about him: his Greek Cypriot background, a sense which will be illustrated by the interview clip, that he had looked into the depths of European history and culture, the turbulence of the post-Holocaust years, and identified with the oppressed and the suffering. He was, of course, also very charming, deeply interested in others, and a lovely person to discuss ideas with. always interested, ingenious, humorous, thoughtful, challenging in a gentle way. And there was a warmth there, an ability to make one feel special, which was hugely attractive. So we learned together, and when we went to do field work, we circulated our field work ideas and reports to each other in a small circle, which we named, naturally enough, after Malinowski, the Cooler Ring. As the years progressed, I kept in touch with Peter and watched his achievements with admiration. He established himself as the most interesting English anthropological film theorist and one of the pioneers of ethnographic films. He became a leading figure in Mediterranean studies and in the new fields of migration and dispersed communities. Peter's deep affection and commitment to the people with whom he worked stretched over many years, and this gave his work an historical depth, which his real commitment to historical understanding reinforced. He kept his questions broad, but his investigations were deep and intimate. He wrote lucidly and without pretentiousness or jargon. Many of the qualities which made Peter into one of the most formative figures in my anthropological apprenticeship, and which touched so many of us, are shown in the interview I conducted with him in 2002. Here are just 5 minutes from an hour-long interview, and if you would like to see any more, the interview is up on the web if you just Google Peter Loizos interview.
So.
Are there any people, academics or writers or thinkers outside the LSE who you think have had a great influence on you? Filmmakers, musicians, novelists, writers, or other academics in America, France, anywhere else?
Yeah, what a big question. Well, I've always had a tremendous respect for Kurosawa's early films. I think particularly of Ikiru, a story of a man faced with terminal cancer who decides he's got to do one positive thing with his life. That's a favorite film. Seven Samurai, I've always thought it was a great film. And Rashomon is obviously a very, very strong film. There's one person. I think Hannah Arendt, I had a kind of Arendt phase in which I read a lot of her stuff and thought that she was an interesting thinker who was not in the then current Marxist mold. I didn't quite realize where she was coming from, and I certainly didn't understand everything she wrote, because she has a quite complex and idiosyncratic mind. But I thought the stuff on anti-Semitism and racism in late 19th century France was very powerful. And I don't know, I mean, I think I'm attracted to thinkers who sort of illuminate the bits of the world that I happen to be obsessed with. Primo Levi is powerful for me because from an early age I read about concentration camps and death camps. For some reason I read about them when I was about 8 years of age. The Nuremberg trials were on, and I had learned to read, and I started reading trial stuff in the newspaper, and I couldn't understand it. It was too horrific. And so I would say to my mother, you know, they made lamps out of people's skins. And I can still remember the name of the wardress who had one of these lamps. She was called Ilse Koch. I think she was called the Beast of Belsen, and so on, in by the press. And there were channels to take away rivers of human fat, things like that. So you read that at eight, and I think you return to it. So
we'll stop there. We're running out of time, but if you want to see the rest, it's easily available. Thank you.
Thanks. We're switching out of audio-visual mode. So thank you very much, Alan. The next speaker is John Davis from Oxford. Welcome.
On his first visit to Cyprus, Peter found a platoon of cousins at the Limassol dockside, waiting to greet him and to carry him off to Argati. He was embraced, feasted like a prodigal nephew, and he acquired a family with extensive kin connections, a warmth and welcome. In personal terms, it was the full family experience, unexpected, dazzling, demanding. In professional terms, when he returned a few years later, he had an entree to his field few anthropologists had had before him. Of course, other anthropologists in the Mediterranean had had connections with their field. Lison Tolosana, from Oxford, was a native of Belmonte de los Caballeros, and he thanks his mother and father for their memories of bygone days in his book, and his brother for keeping him in touch with events during my absences. Lison had little to say about the anthropological usefulness or otherwise of his status as a gentleman in Belmonte. Though in 1990s, a Belmonte baker did set up a factory to make cakes from a family recipe, and it became a national, even international business. And in due course, the baker was pleased to make a considerable endowment for anthropology at Complutense. The artisan became a millionaire benefactor and leapfrogged the gentleman. José Cutillero, born in the Alentejo and blessed with a degree in medicine, tried to shed all his local connections and standing in order, as he said, to impersonate an Oxford anthropologist. You should imagine that José and Peter, colleagues for a while here at LSE, discussed fieldwork and morality, and that these discussions informed Peter's own conclusions and confessions. Entries and exits come in different forms, and Peter's carried concomitant difficulties of an ethical sort. Argaki was a hierarchical village, and Peter's education and work gave him a certain standing. But he had no privileged position to divest himself of. His Argaki kin included secure government employees, landowners based in Nicosia, and poor labourers working in advanced old age to irrigate their land. He said he was vampire-like in some respects, and some of his kinsmen thought that he had exploited them. he came to think that younger practitioners of anthropology had found ways of being ethnographers and also supporters of their people, not only during field work, but in the years afterwards. His discussion reveals sensitivity and moral scrupulousness that is absent in the published work of his predecessors, and that is reflected in the work of some of his students, and perhaps you may also discern it in the ASA's ethical guidelines. From the vantage point of an Oxford anthropologist like Cutillero, Lison Tolzana, with or without local connections, the populations of peasant villages or of herding groups appeared roughly equal at the bottom of the European pile. Peter, studying a ramified village of about 1,400 people, was able to record an almost absolute, though unstable, ranking of the adult men. The central element in claims of rank was a man's success in family matters, how he arranged and secured a safe future for his wife and children. So, although one man with his wife's dowry might have twice as much land as his neighbour, that counted for little if he had to divide it among twice as many children. Constancy, honesty were virtues when they secure the well-being of the nuclear family, but were potentially dangerous and threatening if they led a man to adhere publicly and irreversibly to a mere friend or political party. Education and government jobs gave status, but how teachers and officials ranked in oligarchy depended on their conduct as parents of families and as helpers and supporters of fellow villagers in local and national affairs. If you find it difficult in the 21st century to imagine how innovative that work was in the 1960s and 70s, do reread the works of his elders, the then leaders of Mediterranean anthropology. Pitt Rivers, at that time from Oxford, described the villages of Alcalá as egalitarian, even though resources were much more unequally distributed than in Algarve. And a category of people, the señoritos, was endowed with hereditary superiority. Campbell thought that Saragatsani honour was an egalitarian ethos or ideology, more important in an account of their activities than the differences in wealth and influence that distinguished one shepherd from another. In Peter's work, the continuous assessment of others, the perpetual search for hidden motives and likely consequences, the disparagement of others, were indeed levelling tools, but they were associated with attempts and claims to dominate others. Oligarchy villagers struggled to achieve superiority, to capture and consolidate reputation. And one of the weapons in the perpetual struggle to create inequality was to denigrate others' claims to excellence. You can see that as a form of egalitarianism, if you wish, but it is a moral levelling down. Peter's achievement was to make it impossible to claim benevolent, gentlemanly egalitarianism as an essential part of Mediterranean rank and morality. And he did that through a thorough account of the interconnectednesses of wealth, family conduct, connections, and loyalties. In 1973, Boissevain gathered a group of anthropologists working in Europe and got them to write papers on nation and community. Peter was there, but he didn't write a paper. He was a generous contributor to the discussions. His own work anticipated and surpassed all the published contributions. For Peter's canvas was both broader and more detailed than any of ours. Oligarchy villages had politics in the Cold War sense. For some decades, it had leftists and nationalists and rightists in kaleidoscopic combinations, any of them liable to grow terrorists and vigilantes. A man's allegiance in that experiential forest had consequences for his life chances. The arrival of politicians, politics in oligarchy, like the arrival of international market opportunities in early carrots and potatoes and citrus, was a Trojan horse. It brought oligarchy villages within the ambit of Nicosia, Athens, Moscow, Washington, London. It was a broad field for analysis. Lison had been extremely discreet about allegiances and activities in Belmonte during the civil war and dictatorship. José Cutillero professed surprise that his Alain Téjean was at the forefront of the socialist collectivist occupations of agricultural estates in 1974. But since his work and publication were before the Carnation Revolution, his silence may be diplomatic. Peter's acute observation that oligarchy villages classified politics in this national and international sense as outside the normal conduct of oligarchy affairs was quite crucial. He raised and partly answered the question of when and how local social controls on political action break up, leading to razzias, massacres, coups, and invasions. Some have since attempted answers also. For instance, in northern Spain and in the Balkans. And you must hope that somewhere in Tunis, Egypt, Libya, Yemen, anthropologists as subtle as Peter are writing books and articles that describe and analyze the collapse of those controls. Yeah, sure. 1966 was the year that Peter first went to Cyprus to visit his father's country. It was also the year in which Eric Wolff published his essay on kinship, friendship, patronage. And Robert Payne published his In Search of Friendship. Those are conceptual articles trying to sort out the overlap of ideals and roles in a survey of the literature. They are a necessary advance on Pitt Rivers' characterization of patronage as lopsided friendship. Together with Freddie Bailey's and Barth's analyses of competition for resources, they informed Peter's subtle and meticulous work on friendship. Oligarchy villagers cultivated friends, true friends, and treated them with affection and respect and trust. But they were suspicious of kinsmen's friends who could result in diversion of resources away from the family. Peter's account of patronage is exemplary. His predecessors and many of his contemporaries noted instances of it and asked or deduced general principles. In Catholic Europe, for example, they invoked patron saints to attach earthly patronage to a lopsided cosmological order. Peter was more methodical. He made a list of all the positions that gave social power and influence and then worked out who gained them, how they used them, and lost them, and what the dynamic principles might be. It is a huge advance, and not many have followed his example. Friendship is one of the enduring characteristics of Lorenzos himself, as well as a recurrent theme in his anthropological work. Reading his ethnography and his reflections on ethnography, you get an understanding how in an untrusting world, people come to give trust and services to others when they had no kinship or sacramental or public grounds for doing so. Knowing the man, you came rapidly to understand that he was incapable of giving help or advice without also creating a trust, affection, and love. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and sorry to have to hurry on. Johnny Parry from the LSE.
I first met Peter in Adam Cooper's flat in 1970. Adam convened a small discussion group to which I was honoured to be invited. I was still a PhD student, and the other three regulars, Adam, Phil Burnham, and Peter, were my seniors and already had jobs. So I was overawed by the company, but I remember how welcoming Peter was and how encouraging. And it was the same when I first joined the LSE department 4 years later, as it was for countless others. Just read the tributes on the department's website. It was Peter who made the time took the trouble to make new colleagues and new students feel at home. We remained colleagues and friends for nearly four decades, the bond cemented by a much valued family relationship. Jill wrote much of her thesis in our spare room. Our children were of the same age, and our respective firstborn remained fast friends. Though Peter was a serious cineast, while my own relationship with film was through affinity, we admired the same directors. Peter's first degree was in English, and he was far more knowledgeable, but we shared a taste in 19th century literature. When he phoned to tell me that he was dying and I went to see him, what we mainly discussed was Great Expectations. When I wrote a critical appraisal of Robert Gardner's Forest of Bliss, set on the Benares cremation grounds, Peter rebuked me in print. While at Harvard, Gardner had played a crucial role in nurturing Peter's interest in film. His critique was friendly but firm. I had entirely mistaken the film's intentions. The Inglit background was important to the anthropologist he subsequently became, not least to the fact that he wrote four times better than 99% of the rest of us, with an immediacy, fluency, and clarity, with an eye for the telling detail and vignette, and entirely without obfuscation. He was also an ace editor and presided for years over the LSE monographs in social anthropology, an edited man, now JRAI, with real distinction. Not only literary competence, such tasks also require fair-mindedness and the generosity to devote a lot of time to other people's work. And it wasn't only as an editor that Peter displayed those qualities. Again, just read the tributes. The amazing time that he took with colleagues and students, and the terrific patience he displayed towards them. Peter could not only write, but he could also listen. In one of the tributes, Sumantra Bose singles out his lack of vanity. That strongly resonates. I found him a strange mixture of self-deprecation, even intellectual self-doubt, and unshakable conviction in the kind of anthropology that he wanted to do. His vision wasn't the conventional one. In a small department in which people work together for years, everybody at some point gets cross. Patient as he generally was, and though by instinct a peacemaker, Peter was no exception, and was sometimes at loggerheads with the rest of us about the direction the department should take. But one of his most endearing qualities was that even when really riled, he didn't bear grudges for long. And I'd expect that he would even forgive me what follows. What follows is that it was just a few years back, and we were having dinner in our kitchen with Peter and Jill and another guest. He and I were talking about work we might do in the future, and he was saying that he no longer wanted to write about Cyprus, and I was insistently telling him that he must. Over-insistently, obviously. Peter erupted volcanically, and to stun dinner table silence, told me that I was an insensitive creep. I was mystified at the time, as I think was everybody else around the table. But especially since Peter's died, I've been mulling it over, and I think I now better understand why I had touched such a raw nerve. And I think it says something about Peter, the anthropologist. Levi-Strauss famously claimed that we anthropologists are the astronomers of the social sciences, whose privileged epistemological position is the view from afar. While I imagine that few today would readily identify with that self-description, I doubt that there can be any to whose experience of fieldwork it would be more alien than to Peter. True, many of us develop genuinely close relationships in the field, often over many years. And if communal bloodletting breaks out, we worry about our friends, do whatever we can to alleviate their plight, and may even try to use our limited professional authority to intervene in the situation. What most of us don't generally feel is that we are personally responsible for it, or even directly implicated. Now, recall the biographical details. The son of an exiled Greek Cypriot father, who he hardly sees before adulthood, Peter is brought up by his Irish mother, an isolated and lonely childhood. When she dies, he re-establishes contact with his father, visits Cyprus, and is met off the boat by a delegation of village men who warmly embrace him as kin and whisk him off to Argaki. 2 years later, he returns to Cyprus for fieldwork, and Argaki claims him as his son. He simply could not do his research in any other village. Of course, he has unprecedented access and does brilliant ethnography. But that goes with an unusual burden of moral constraint. Of course, we all have to grapple with what we can say about our informants, about what privileged information we can use. But it's not quite the same if they're family. Over the years, the problem gets worse. As a military coup, Turkey invades Cyprus. Argaki winds up 3 miles behind the Green Line in Turkish-occupied territory. The Greek majority from the village are displaced, and the island effectively partitioned. Peter, the peacemaker, can't stay silent, and during the interminable aftermath, writes a whole battery of newspaper articles and semi-official reports to explain the crisis and promote its solution. But that means pointing out that the Greek Cypriots do not have a complete monopoly of virtue. By the time what he has actually said has been filtered by the politicians, to many in Argaki, it seems that the young man they had claimed as their own is aiding and abetting the enemy. Though this dilemma is not unique, what Peter had to confront in a peculiarly heightened and wrenching form was the tension between the holy grail of academic objectivity and the sense of obligation to informants. It was never a comfortable position, and I believe it marked his career as an anthropologist. So Peter was right. With hindsight, my failure to empathize with his wish to disengage from the politics of Cyprus was insensitively obtuse. But what was equally marked was the impulsion to remain involved and to try to make some difference. And making a difference was why anthropology might matter. While others of us might say that the objective of the subject is to learn something about human nature in general, or that we'd hope to contribute to a critical understanding of society, what I believe preoccupied Peter was being of some practical use, of doing some good. As I would see it, that's all of a piece with his decidedly ecumenical approach to the subject, his willingness to engage with neighbouring disciplines. Peter had close relationships with and sustained conversations that spanned a number of LSE departments, which is what made him such a good citizen of the school. So, having formulated a hypothesis about what I've decided made Peter the anthropologist and colleague he was, obviously the most interesting reaction to it for me would be that of Peter himself. But I'm sure I'm not the only person in the room who regrets the conversations with him that we never got round to completing.
Thanks, Johnny. Now, some people from further afield. Janet Carson from Edinburgh.
I have a vivid memory from the late 1970s when I was quite a new student in the department here, during a time of personal upset, of being taken for a much-needed coffee break by Peter to the little cafe in Lincoln's Inn Fields. Peter's sympathetic probing into some of the messier familial background of what was troubling me was characteristic of his empathy and kindness. Humane interest and his own brand of quizzical curiosity combined, one felt, to make him a teacher and friend who often noticed and always cared about what was going on in the lives and hearts of those around him. Many students, no doubt, have reason to recall such gestures years later with gratitude. The interweaving of personal and anthropological threads runs through The Heart-Grown Bitter, a work in which Peter's own familial connections are made an intrinsic part of his attempt to lay bare the experiences of refugees in Cyprus. A combination of sympathy, personal ties, and an effort to grapple anthropologically with the forms of refugees' loss of homes, land, and a way of life resonate through this work. But of course, an understanding of the myriad ways in which personal background shapes an anthropologist's work was there in Peter's case from the beginning. At the start of The Heart-Grown Bitter, he describes his first arrival in Cyprus in 1966 on a six-week holiday when, at the age of 29, he had, for reasons that were still unclear, given up a job at the BBC. The first sight of Cyprus was alarming and took me by surprise. It was about 5:30 a.m., and when I came on deck, the Paphos coast loomed large on the port side of the boat, as the boat made for Limassol. It was the bare, parched quality of the yellow hills that immediately disturbed me, for it seemed that in so inhospitable a landscape, no one could live at all, let alone live at ease. Perhaps Cyprus was an awful rural slum in which people would be suffering vastly simply to survive. From a few miles out to sea, the sparse dark trees on the hills seemed to offer little sustenance. I did not then know the olive and the carob, and just how nourishing in their different ways they are. After watching the shoreline for a while without seeing anything more encouraging than sheep, I went below to make sure my baggage was in order. In this initial chapter, as we've already heard, Peter goes on to recount his arrival, how when the boat had docked, he was immediately seized upon by his cousins and taken to his father's village, Argaki. There, inevitably, a feast ensued. And I'm going to read a short part of Peter's memorable evocation of that first meeting with his father's relatives in his own beautifully crafted words. People had been waiting a long time to eat, and now they started. I found my plate piled high with all kinds of ceremonial foods, stuffed vine leaves, roast goat, lamb, chicken, red gold roast potatoes, salad with piquant coriander, macaroni stuffed with mincemeat, which alone would have made a very acceptable meal in London. Whenever I made a small hole in the food on my plate, an aunt would seize a particularly juicy chicken leg or chunk of goat and swoop it down on my plate. If I cunningly tried to control this cornucopia, I was urged on with the words, "Faye a come, Ligo," eat a little more, or more imperatively, "Faye, Petro." My glass was being continually refilled as well. It took me some time to realise that whenever I picked it up, everyone else picked up theirs. In Cypriot village company, you do not drink alone, in your own time, or simply when you feel like it. You drink ceremonially together, and each round emphasises the collective nature of the event. Since I did not understand this, and was also the guest of honour, my bad manners were being redefined and overlooked, and instead I was being treated as a kind of toastmaster or pacemaker, even though I was not making any toasts. Pakis, on my right, was bearing the brunt of the ceremonies, since he was translating all the remarks addressed from all sides of the room to me, as well as my numbed and fumbling attempts to reply in the spirit of the event. Now he said to me that he thought I must make some kind of speech. What happened next surprised even me, and looking back, it seems that on a quieter level, it had been in preparation for some time. I began. When I was a small boy at school in England, I did not look particularly Greek, and because, as you know, I was brought up by my mother, I did not speak any Greek, only English, like any Englishman. And yet I had a long Greek name, Papaloizou, and this name caused me a great deal of trouble. For some reason, the English children found it odd that I should look so English and yet have a name which to the English seems funny. So they used to tease me about it. And of course, like any child, I didn't like being teased. It used to get me into trouble and fights. For many years, I carried this name around, wondering why my mother hadn't done the sensible thing and given me an English name, so I could be exactly like everybody else. Now, coming here after so long and meeting you all for the first time, I feel all those difficult childhood years were worthwhile. This speech, which though apt, was also from the heart, produced a strong effect on the people at the table, some of whom were visibly moved and all of whom were very attentive, while Pakis relayed the contents in Greek. Further things were said to me, to make me feel even more at home, and the one that I had never forgotten was the dialect proverb which Thomas produced. Upios echi vendro, echi skios. This was probably the first respectable sentence of the dialect that I learned. It means, whoever has a tree has shade, whoever has kinsmen has protection.
Thanks very much. And now, your colleague, Toby Kelly from Edinburgh.
I feel very honoured to have been asked to say a few words today about Peter, a man who was so important in so many people's lives. To be honest, I had not realised quite how important Peter was in my own life until I heard the sad news about his ill health earlier this year. But I suppose that was the whole point about Peter. He went about things in an understated manner, without fanfare, but the impact of the things he did and said will be enduring. What I want to do for the next few minutes is to talk about Peter as a teacher and supervisor. I count myself privileged, as do so many other people, to have been taught by him. When I was thinking about the things I wanted to say today, I contacted many of the other people who had been taught by him. What struck me was the overwhelming affection and respect with which he was held, and I hope that I can do some of these sentiments justice. A few days ago, a colleague of mine sent me a short unpublished paper that Peter had written about the various things he had learned over the years about being a PhD supervisor. particularly one whose students had a habit of going off to seemingly more dangerous parts of the world. In this paper, a typical example of Peter's lucid and to-the-point prose, he concludes that supervising students is more of an art than a science. If this is true, as it surely is, Peter was a master. I've learnt many things from Peter, to the extent that whenever I find myself confronted with a potentially tricky student, I ask myself, what would Peter do? I'm not sure if I can ever fully answer that question, but I know that if I could, it would be the right thing. Peter was always aware that his students' lives could be complicated and that their well-being was the most important thing. I remember during my own fieldwork in Palestine at the heart of the Second Intifada that he kept on raising the issue of whether I should return to the UK. At the time, I found it slightly irritating, but I now recognise that he was trying to give me a get-out clause, testing if I really wanted to come back, but was too proud to say no. It was typical Peter. His style and great strength as a supervisor was to always give you the space to make up your own mind, whilst giving you wise advice on the best way to do it. He had the ability to think himself inside your project rather than to impose his own perspective. It was a kind of intellectual empathy which is so rare. It was this that enabled him to engage with students across a wide range of regions and topics. At the same time, though, he would never put up with overly fashionable clichés that obscured rather than revealed what you really wanted to say. Even now, I imagine him sitting next to me, asking whether I really meant that and what it meant anyway. He once told me that I was a meat and two veg anthropologist. I now take this as a compliment and remember it almost every time I sit down to write. It was a measure of Peter that he never saw his job as being done the moment his students graduated. Many of my fellow former students have told me in the last few months how he continued to read and comment on their drafts years and sometimes even decades after his formal responsibilities had come to an end. He never got the sense that he saw this as a burden, but rather engaged in intellectual discussion with enthusiasm, generosity, and occasional mischievousness. Alongside so many other people, I also learned what I take to be the most important lesson about the anthropological project from Peter, in terms of his own commitment to examine the familiar and to find ways to question our most taken for granted assumptions. Peter's own work is a model of how to raise questions about the things closest to us, but to do so with grace, taking other people's worries and concerns seriously. The skills with which he managed this trick, especially when researching his own extended family, is profoundly impressive. His healthy scepticism never tipped into cynicism. Most importantly, Peter never forgot that we are people first and anthropologists second. It is a warm and caring man that I will remember Peter most. Indeed, when I spoke to Alice Forbes, another of his former students, about what I should say today, she told me that her greatest memory of Peter, and I quote, was his willingness to engage in anything, his enthusiasm for adventure and his intense joy, his being there fully, taking chances and making the most of the moment. The humanity that Peter brought to his written work, his teaching, and most importantly, the rest of his life, is an important lesson to us all. I will miss him greatly.
Thanks, Toby. And now Joe DeBerry, who's come here all the way from America.
Only too pleased to have crossed the Atlantic and to stand here in this full hall to pay tribute to Peter. And I know for certain that my own reflection on Peter's supportive and influential role as my PhD supervisor, as my mentor and my friend, is confirmed and consistent row after row here in the experience of others. And even the sum of the gratitude in this room is only a part of it. So it is very humbling to try and give form and words to the thanks that we feel. Being supervised by Peter was to embark on a big, wide, well-informed, and enduring conversation. one he pursued with a mixture of insight and curiosity. For me, that conversation started as I set off in the mid-90s to eastern Uganda to study the recovery of a war-scarred and displaced people. This week, I look back at the many letters Peter sent whilst I was in the field. They reminded me of just how very engaged he was. He sent pages of reflections on the raw ethnography I was churning. His typed pages were often followed by a hand-scribbled note, a page or more. He clearly went on thinking about it all well beyond the confines of his initial signing off. The letters are remarkable because they are essentially a lot of questions, as he asks and he encourages me to probe. They give fine illustration to that old adage that the best teachers are those who tell you where to look, but not what to see. And then, after my PhD was over and the thesis submitted, the conversation was so interesting and easy that we just carried on conversing, discussing other wars and other refugees that I've worked with in West Africa, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Georgia, and Azerbaijan. And we discussed much else of life besides. We talked our way into the friendship that Peter had a huge capacity for, and like Johnny, I'm all too sorry that that conversation has now closed. Peter's lasting legacy to my work was to help me explore in the refugee and displacement experience the yoking together of loss and hope, of shame and dignity, of suffering and resilience, of dependence and self-reliance. He helped me to clarify the resources that make people strong despite weakness, the wounds that make them frail despite healing. And now, as I work on large development projects for the displaced, I always strive to build this in, the recognition that it is in the social, the emotional, and the psychological dimensions of being a refugee. Those dimensions are where successful interventions are to be crafted and development failures to be understood. Peter helped me to this understanding through academic rigor and in facilitating me frame my own ethnography. But essentially, he also achieved it through introductions to like-minded people, many of whom are here this afternoon. He helped build a community of us, and our working together and collaboration down the years has been a rich source of enjoyment and support. He was tremendously loyal to the cause. Last year, I asked him to review an important research piece I'd proposed for the World Bank to undertake in support of the 600,000 internally displaced people in Azerbaijan. He was a strong champion. It was his gravitas and the authority wrought by his long reflection on displacement issues which helped us clinch the support of senior management and the government to go ahead. And the research has set in place a new and exciting engagement for these most marginal of persons. I read The Heart Grown Bitter soon after my return, after 18 months in the field. What a relief it was to read a book that was both fully anthropological and fully personal. I was struggling to know how to turn my fieldwork, that exhilarating and bewildering journey beyond comfort, into a thesis. What to do with the moonlit nights when we danced under the stars, the entangled relationships, the tragic deaths, my ineptitude for surviving in a famine-struck land, the lifetime obligations formed, the life-changing friendships made. And if those thick descriptions didn't make it into the final thesis, there was at least in The Heart Grown Bitter a precedent, a permission granted for acknowledging the messy, wonderful encounters of where it all came from and what it was actually all about. For Peter, anthropology was always about people. His was a rich and honest vocabulary for the humanity of the folk that underpinned it all. It was exactly the example I needed for describing the trials and courage of life in a war-torn land. Much has already been said about his talent for compassion, which pervaded how he approached being a supervisor, and just how very kind he was. Interspersed amongst his letters, I found a handwritten note sent when my fieldwork assistant died. It was typical of his abundant empathy and concern. And he filled his letters with constant encouragement, exhortations to stay safe, not work too hard, to draw a line, to have rest, and to have more fun. He was endlessly supportive of my career choices, responsive to all the many references I always requested. But if I have to choose one outstanding quality that he brought to his role as a supervisor, it was simply that he dearly liked and enjoyed his students. That so many of us became his friends is testimony to this. Peter drew great vitality from his contact with those set on learning, and that shone through his interactions. You can sense his excitement as another academic year starts at LSE in this description at the end of one of his letters. The LSE start of year buzz is on, the overcrowding while new students mill around unsure of their timetables, making new friends, sitting in on courses to see if they can come up, if they have the time for extra things. And the enthusiasm of bright, expectant people with lots of energy. I do believe it re-energizes us. For those supervised by Peter, it was our very good fortune that he considered it his very good fortune to have us around.
Thanks very much. So we're running slightly over time, but we can't really curb people, so I will have to possibly curb this one. So welcome to Akis Papadakiakis, who came here from Greece.
I would like to speak from the perspective of a person who knew Peter for 37 years. A student, colleague and partner in collaborative projects, co-citizen engaged in the politics of the Hellenic world, and personal friend. Peter inherited from the paternal side of his family just a long Greek surname, Papaloizou. He did not actually have a father, paternal care or the fatherland. As he confessed in an interview, I grew up with my mother and with a long surname, Papaloizou. Since I did not have a close connection with my father, I had nothing with which to fill the empty box of my name. This empty signifier eventually became a source of troubles and anxiety, a reminder of a traumatic childhood. He often recalled the painful memory of his Dulwich teacher, who used to call him a Greek tragedy. The long name was not just foreign to others, it was foreign to himself. Shortening it into Loizos did not reduce the burden of this vacuum. His first trip to Cyprus in 1966 was a decisive step in solving the puzzle of the empty name. He was 29 and did not speak Greek. His father had prepared the ground. At his arrival to the port of Limassol, he heard that a policeman was looking for him. Because of his father's communist past, he became terrified that the authorities would turn him back. To his great surprise, the young policeman presented himself as his cousin Lefteris. In Peter's words, he was smiling now, and grasping my hand, pulling me towards him and embracing me with formal kisses, first one cheek, then the other. I knew this was not a good time to be very English about men kissing each other. And I also knew where I had seen these eyes before, in the shaving mirror. They were remarkably like my own, and indeed, with a similar moustache, a suntan, and a slightly different hairstyle, I could have passed as his brother. We also appeared to be the same age. In Argaki, the generous hospitality of his relatives overwhelmed him. Suddenly, Peter says, I had a very huge kin group, and they made terrific fuss of me. They made me feel stay forever in the village. What followed this first visit is well known. Peter became addicted to his new home. His life was divided between and before and an after this decisive event. That's his own words. The ancestral village became the site of his first major fieldwork. Then the fate of his local kin and their friends and neighbors, their involvement in civil strife, then war and dislocation, became intertwined with his academic career. His second ethnographic and political involvement in Cyprus became a sort of kin work. With this, he closed the open account with his father, again his own words, and recovered the lost bond to the paternal side of his personal world. Peter was a passionate field worker and an eclectic who opposed grand theorizing and abstract thinking. The Argaki trilogy that has put Cyprus on the anthropological map is an excellent example of his eclecticism. However, behind this mosaic of theoretical influences and methodological strategies applied in this trilogy, there is a common thread that gives coherence to his work. I provisionally call it ethnographic humanism, an anthropocentric approach, focusing on concrete individuals and their struggles for well-being, an imaginative and empathetic perspective that puts humans and their experiences at the center. Peter's humanism was not just philosophical or methodological. It was a humanism of character and moral conviction. He wanted to do good to the world. His commitment to his kin and informants governed his role as public intellectual and was a source of psychological strain, something that Johnny discussed previously. I first met Peter in 1975, when I came to London to do undergraduate studies in anthropology. I was one of the Greeks with a long surname. Among many factors, his name made the difference that brought me at the LSE. A Greek connection in the brave new world I was entering was assuring. I remember my great surprise to find that behind the Greek name was a British, an English, an Irish, to my eyes at that moment he was an Irish, guy with long sideburns. His sympathy and humorous respect of my idiosyncrasies, which are a lot, helped me overcome the initial shock. Our relationship developed in the intellectually dazzling environment of the LSE Anthropology Department of the late 70s. We were so different, no doubt. At least, that was what I thought then. The theoreticism and confident arrogance of the young structural Marxist of that day troubled him. We battled over my long sentences, yet we found a working balance that helped me to refashion myself as an ethnographer, to write a thesis in English, to get rid of some of my certainties. Later, when I returned to Greece with the apostolic mission to spread the anthropological word in my country, he was there to offer me support. The teacher became a patient and generous partner in joint projects. The teacher became a friend. It took me, however, many years to understand that I was part of the bond that he worked so hard to recover, that his ethnographic work was part of a difficult personal journey, which on the way increasingly looked similar to my effort to become part of his English world. His struggle with a long name was so familiar to me. We were long-term travelers, moving into opposite directions. While he was inventing a fatherland, I was working hard to achieve distance from mine. We met middle on the road, in a partial connection that was intellectually challenging and emotionally rewarding. I saw Peter for the last time in Athens a year ago. He stayed in my place. We had dinner together with Effie and his ex-students, Leonidas and Marina. We walked in the nearby park of Kesariani and talked a lot. He was relaxed and in good form. We had tea in the local pastry, and he left a little earlier for the airport in order to avoid delays. I have a sweet memory of this last meeting. Yet I regret that I did not tell him, not then, not ever, how convincing and charming I found his performance in conferences, how much I liked his voice, which reminded me of Sean Connery. How funny I found his bodily language, the distinctively Loizos intensive look in the eyes, this investigative grimace, asking for more close communication, or his intriguing relation with Maccabity, his lazy cat. How much I appreciated his sense of openness, equality, generosity and fellowship to younger colleagues. How challenging I found his anti-authoritarianism. I mean, Peter, it was structurally impossible for him to exercise authority. That helped me become a better person. How much I owe to him. A loving friend who cared for me in difficult times. It is at least comforting to acknowledge these feelings, my debt, in public, in front of his beloved ones.
Thank you very much, Akis. Finally, Jill will say a couple of words.
Yes, very brief.
I just wanted to say something about the sort of final period of Peter's relationship to Cyprus. If you think of the first period as being up to 74 and the invasion and his first fieldwork, if you think of the second period as that long middle period when he was struggling to, as others have described very well, find a role between being a kinsman and being a professional anthropologist, and finding it a very painful, difficult role. We saw from the home side how extremely hard it was to juggle and to fail to juggle those two roles, if you like. It was also a period when there were a lot of complex things going on in our family at home. And during that period, he went less to Cyprus and he worked on books in London. But I think the third period is a very important one. The third period I date more or less from when he retired from the LSE. And when he developed a new relationship with Cyprus, he taught part-time in Intercollege, a private university in Nicosia. He had very good friends in that university and very good friends in the government university in Nicosia as well. And I think that was a joyful, sunlit uplands stage of his life back in Cyprus, teaching, consolidating that set of friendships with academics, producing new kinds of books, one on refugee health, two books of photographs, a collection of scattered earlier works published through Intercollege, and research on masculinity. Though this period was less than a decade in length, it was a period which compensated for a lot of those tough times earlier and left Peter with a strong sense of completion by the time he died. Out of this final period, and in fact since he died, have come three important results, all of which he would have been delighted by and actually amazed by. First, a large and remarkably affectionate memorial for him in Nicosia, funded by the two universities in which he had colleagues. Secondly, a home for his large personal library of books on Cyprus, the Mediterranean and refugees, which has gone to an intercommunal library based in the buffer zone between the Greek and Turkish halves of Cyprus, where scholars from both sides can consult his work. It's not his own work, it's his collection of books, so can consult his library, if you like. And finally, to our amazement at the house, we received a letter of condolence to the family from the presidential palace in Nicosia. I'll read you just a part of it. It said, "Your husband will be remembered as a distinguished academic whose fieldwork in Argaki was a seminal contribution to the field of anthropology. His research placed Cyprus on academic bookshelves all over the world. Cypriots from all walks of life are indebted to your husband. On behalf of the people and the government of Cyprus, I wish to convey sincere and heartfelt condolences to you and your family." So, although a shortened life, it was a life which had a completeness to it, and that is a comfort to us, his family, and I think it will be too to his friends and colleagues. We'll always miss him, but we're glad he didn't die with an awareness of tasks uncompleted professionally or things unsaid at home. He did them all and said them all.
Yesterday would have been Peter's 75th birthday. So, in his Christmas letter to his friends, when he knew he was dying, he asked everybody to raise a glass to him on that day. And you are now invited to come and do that and have a truly Cypriot-style, hopefully, wake upstairs in the senior common room, which is across in the old building up on the fifth floor. And it just remains for me to thank everyone who came here for all your inputs and to thank everybody who's arrived to give Peter such a good send-off. So thanks again.